Picture this. It's the morning of June 16, 1943. Somewhere over the Solomon Sea, a single Boeing B-17E is droning along at 25,000 feet, all by herself, no fighter escort, no wingman, nothing but four Wright Cyclones and a lot of empty Pacific underneath her. Her crew calls her Old 6066, and in about an hour, that airplane is going to be jumped by between 17 and 20 Japanese fighters. And what happens next is going to result in two medals of honor being pinned to the tunics of two different men from the same crew. The only time in the history of American aviation that that has ever happened on a single mission in a single airplane. Pull up a chair. I'm Tail Dragger. This is The Hangar on Radio Hangar, and today we are going to tell you the story of the most highly decorated single combat mission in United States Army Air Force's history. Before we get into it, today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot ticket, instrument rating, commercial, all the way up. If you have earned it, they have a coin for it. And every coin tells a story, which is awfully appropriate for today's segment, because the story we are about to tell you is exactly the kind of thing those coins were made to honor. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's set the table. Spring of 1943 in the South Pacific is a nasty business. The Guadalcanal campaign has finally wound down. The Allies are starting to claw their way up the Solomon Island chain, one stinking jungle airstrip at a time, and the planners at 5th Air Force have got their eyes on a place called Bougainville, Big Island, northern end of the Solomons, heavily defended, and right at the top end of Bougainville, separated by a narrow strait, is a smaller island called Buka with a Japanese airfield on it that needed to be photographed before the invasion could be planned. The job goes to the 43rd Bomb Group, the famous Ken's men, flying out of Port Moresby, New Guinea. They need somebody to take a B-17, fly it solo, in broad daylight over a fighter base, get clean photographs of every inch of the coastline, then continue on another 200 miles to photograph Bougainville itself. 1,200 miles round trip, mostly over open water, no escort, no friends, nobody volunteers for that mission, nobody, that is, except a young captain named Jay Zeemer, and the crew he had cobbled together out of misfits and oddballs that the rest of the squadron didn't really want. Now here's where it gets interesting. Jay Zeemer was a character. He was tall, lanky, kind of quiet, Cornell graduate mechanical engineer by training. He had been flying B-26 Marauders early in the war, and the truth of it is, he was not considered a particularly good Marauder pilot. He bounced his landings. He had trouble with the Marauder's high wing loading. They actually washed him out of first pilot duties for a while, but Zeemer wanted to fly. He wanted to fly bad, so he transferred over to B-17s, and he started picking up missions wherever he could get them, flying as a co-pilot on other people's airplanes when his own crew didn't have one. And in his off hours, he and his bombardier, a quiet Polish-American kid from Pennsylvania named Joseph Sarnowski, started rebuilding a Hangar Queen. That's where Old 66 comes in. The airplane was a B-17E, tail number 41, 2666. She had been beat up, written off as not combat worthy, and parked off in a corner of the field at Port Moresby to be cannibalized for parts. She was old, she was tired, she had been patched and repatched, but Zeemer and his crew started working on her in their spare time, and over the course of weeks and months, they didn't just bring her back to life. They modified her into something else entirely. They added guns. Lots of guns. The standard B-17E carried a single 50 caliber in the nose, fired by the bombardier through a flexible socket. Zeemer's crew installed a forward-firing fixed 50 caliber that the pilot could fire by pressing a button on the yoke, like a fighter. They added another fixed gun in the nose. They upgunned the waist positions to twin 50s by the time they were done. That airplane had 19 50 caliber machine guns on it. A standard B-17 had 13. Old 666 bristled like a porcupine. She also had something else. She had a crew that had flown together, fought together, and trusted each other. They were the volunteers nobody else wanted, and they had become, by some accounts, the best B-17 crew in the Southwest Pacific. So when the Buka mission came up and the colonel asked who would take it, Zeemer raised his hand. The plan was to take off from Port Moresby in the dark, climb out over the Owen Stanley Mountains, head north across the Solomon Sea, hit Bougainville at first light, and get those photographs before the Japanese could scramble fighters from Buka. In, out, home for breakfast. It did not work out that way. They took off at 4 in the morning. Engines turning sweet, all four of those cyclones humming, Zeemer in the left seat, Lieutenant John Britton in the right, Sarnowski down in the nose, a photographer named William Kendrick in the radio compartment, navigator Ruby Johnston, tail gunner Forrest Dillman, waist gunners Bud Thews and George Pugh, top turret and engineer Johnny Abel, ball turret Bill Vaughn, 10 men, one airplane, one ocean. They made landfall on Bougainville right on schedule, just as the sun was coming up, and they started running their photo lines, three lines, north to south, mapping the coastline. 40 minutes of straight and level flight at 25,000 feet, no evasive action. You can't photograph if you're maneuvering. You have to fly the airplane like it's nailed to a rail. They were on the third pass, almost done, when the tail gunner called out fighters. Zeros, a whole pile of them, coming up from Buca. The official count was somewhere between 17 and 20 Japanese fighters, mostly S6M Zeros, but with some Kawasaki Ki-61 Tonys mixed in. They came up in waves, they came up from below, from above, from every quarter. And old 66 was alone, in clear morning sky, no clouds to hide in, 200 miles from the nearest friendly airfield. And her crew was about to fight for their lives for the next 40 minutes. The first pass killed them, almost. A 20mm cannon shell punched through the nose plexiglass and exploded right in front of Joe Sarnowski. He was thrown back out of the bombardier's compartment, into the navigator's well, blood pouring out of him, fragments in his side. Another shell exploded in the cockpit. Zimmer caught fragments in both legs, in his arms. His left wrist was nearly severed. He had a wound in his side. The right rudder pedal was shot away. The hydraulic lines were leaking. The oxygen system was on fire. Co-pilot Britton was hit. Navigator Johnston was hit. Pretty much everybody in the front of that airplane was bleeding. But here's the thing about Sarnowski, that kid lying there in the navigator's well, bleeding out with a hole in his side big enough to put your fist through, he crawled. He crawled forward, back to the nose of that airplane, back to his 50 caliber machine gun, with the wind whistling through the shattered plexiglass and the temperature down around 20 below zero, and he got back behind that gun. And when the next zero came in, head on, Joe Sarnowski shot it down, and then he shot down another one, and then he collapsed across his gun and died right there in the nose of the airplane. Two confirmed kills, after he had been mortally wounded, from a position any other man would have considered already dead. Up in the cockpit, Zimmer was flying the airplane, with one functional leg and one functional arm, blood pooling in the seat beneath him, and he was doing something B-17s were never meant to do. He was dogfighting. He was throwing that airplane around the sky like a Mustang, diving away from attacks, skidding the airplane sideways with rudder to throw off the fighter's aim, climbing back up to give his gunners better firing positions. The crew claimed 5 Japanese fighters shot down, and another 5 damaged. The Japanese records, what survives of them, suggest the actual number may have been lower, but it doesn't really matter. What matters is they kept that airplane in the air. The fight finally broke off when Zimmer dove the airplane down to about 10,000 feet, and the Zeros, low on fuel, broke off and turned for home. And then the real ordeal began, because now they had to fly home. 600 miles over open ocean, in an airplane that was barely flying. The number 2 engine was running rough. The hydraulics were gone, which meant no flaps and no brakes when they got home. The oxygen system was destroyed, which meant they had to stay low, which meant they had to burn more fuel. There was a hole the size of a kitchen table in the nose. Half the crew was wounded. Zimmer himself, by now, had lost so much blood that he was drifting in and out of consciousness. The co-pilot was doing most of the flying. But every time something needed to be decided, every time a course change needed to be made, somebody would shake Zimmer awake, ask him the question, and he would croak out an answer and pass out again. They flew like that for almost 5 hours. When they finally crossed the Owen Stanley Mountains and started looking for an airfield, the first one they tried, Dobadura, had weather closed in on it, so they pressed on to a fighter strip called Ward's, and Britton put that airplane down on the runway, with no flaps and no brakes, and she rolled out and stopped. And the war, for that crew, on that day, was over. The medics climbed up into the airplane and they thought Zimmer was already dead. He was so cold and so still. They put him on a stretcher and they were carrying him off when somebody noticed his eyes were open and he was watching them. Joe Sarnowski was dead. 5 other crew members were wounded. Ruby Johnston, the navigator, badly. Several others, less badly. But they all came home. And the photographs, they got the photographs. Every frame Kendrick had been ordered to shoot. The mission was a complete success. Zimmer spent 15 months in hospitals. He had over 120 pieces of metal in his body. The doctors didn't think he would walk again, much less fly. He proved them wrong on both counts. He never flew combat again, because his wounds wouldn't allow it, but he stayed in the Air Force Reserves, retired as a lieutenant colonel, became an aerospace engineer after the war, worked on the Apollo program. He passed in 2007 at the age of 88. Joe Sarnowski was 28 years old when he died on his gun in the nose of that airplane. His Medal of Honor was awarded posthumously. There's an airfield named for him in Pennsylvania, where he grew up, Old 666. Well, they patched her up one more time. She flew a few more missions. And then, like so many other warbirds, she was scrapped at the end of the war. There's no surviving piece of her that anybody knows of today. But here's what I want you to take away from this. That airplane, the one that did all of that, the one that took two medals of honor into the sky. She was a hangar queen. She was the airplane nobody wanted. She was patched together by a crew nobody wanted, led by a pilot the brass had nearly washed out. And on a Wednesday morning in June of 1943, that crew and that airplane did something that nobody, in the 80-some years since, has ever matched. There's a lesson in that, maybe more than one, about what hands and hearts can do with an airplane that the paperwork has written off, about what a crew can become when nobody expects anything of them, about what a quiet bombardier from the coal country of Pennsylvania can do when the moment finally comes and asks him for everything he has got. Pilots are made of strange stuff, always have been, the good ones anyway. Most of the details on this one come from Bob Doerr's reporting in Air Force Magazine and from John Bruning's book Indestructible, plus the official Medal of Honor citations themselves, which are worth reading on their own. You can find more on this story and others over at radiohanger.com. Joe Sarnowski, Jay Zeemer, Old 666, names worth remembering. This is Taildragger, Keep Her Between the Ditches.